This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the fall of 1976, a man named Joseph Sledge escaped from a North Carolina prison, only to return a few days later. And this time he was charged with a new crime, one he did not commit. He spent the last 34 years trying to convince the court and the public of his innocence. Finally, evidence turned up that proved he was right. And still, he's in jail. If Joseph Sledge is exonerated, he'll be the oldest and longest-serving wrongfully convicted inmate in North Carolina. Mandy Locke has been reporting on Joseph Sledge and has followed the stories of other North Carolina inmates. She's a reporter with the News and Observer and joins us today on The State of Things. Mandy, welcome.
Great to be here.
Tell us the story of Joseph Sledge, how he came to be in prison and then convicted of a crime he didn't commit.
It's undeniable that Joseph Sledge was always in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it couldn't have turned out worse for him than it did in 1976. He was serving time at a small minimum security prison down in Bladen County, and he escaped one night because he was having a beef with another inmate. Little did he know that just 5 miles down the road, the next day, a mother and her daughter would be brutally murdered. So for investigators, Joseph Sledge was an obvious suspect from day one.
Obvious suspect. He had a trial. He was convicted pretty quickly. This is 1976. What kind of evidence did they have, material evidence, linking him to the crime?
He wasn't actually tried until 1978, and it took him 2 tries to do it. The first ended in a hung jury. But the sole evidence against Joseph Sledge at his trial was the testimony of 2 jailhouse snitches, informants, who agreed to testify against him. And those informants were not interviewed until February of 1978, just some months before he went to trial. There was absolutely no physical evidence ever linking Joseph Sledge to this crime.
You know, it's kind of interesting because on the surface, you think it's a slam dunk. You have an escapee 5 miles down the road from the camp. You have these brutal murders. And, you know, this should be an easy case. Yet it took two years and there was no material evidence. So, as you suggest, there really was not much linking him until these snitches turn up 2 years later. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And very recently, Frank, in addition to the DNA evidence that has recently surfaced in the case, very recently, the only living jailhouse snitch, one of the two is dead, and the only one that's still living, has recanted his statement. He said that he was lured by investigators to offer the testimony, told that there was a reward in the case, that he could be released early on parole. And he says that they also told him that he was a suspect in the murders, and if he didn't cooperate, that they would arrest him. So this is all very recent development. So even evidence that now, in today's times, we wouldn't consider particularly significant has sort of fallen away in the case of Joseph Sledge.
So tell us about the evidence they did have. I think that's a fascinating element in this trial. In 1978, there was some evidence at the crime scene, and somehow it was linked to Joseph Sledge. Tell us about that.
So this was a really brutal slaying, a very bloody crime scene. It was a mother and her grown daughter. They lived together, and someone came into their home and stabbed them to death. The daughter was also raped. Her body was exposed, her clothes lifted up, and investigators found at the time some hairs, both pubic and head hairs, on her body, on her exposed torso, and then on her forehead, smeared in blood. So investigators were smart enough at the time to collect that hair evidence, and they thought it significant enough at the time to send it away to the FBI lab to have them do as sophisticated as testing as was available at the time, which was not very sophisticated. They determined that the hair belonged to a black man, and they looked at it under the microscope compared to Joseph Sledge's hairs and determined that it was microscopically consistent. So essentially, it could have been his. Fast forward 34 years now, and we know, based on DNA testing, that the hairs absolutely were not his.
And tell us about those DNA tests and what it took to recover the evidence that could link the actual perpetrator to the crime, to do the DNA test and find out that it wasn't Joseph Sledge.
So DNA testing started to become widely available in the mid-1990s, and Joseph Sledge knew that this science had evolved and it was available. So in 1993, he began writing letter after letter after letter to the courts with a simple request to have evidence from his case tested for DNA. He said that he knew the moment they would test it that it would exonerate him and that he would be a free man. So he wrote letter after letter with very, very, very limited success. One order to test the evidence was just blatantly ignored by the investigators in the district attorney's office. And so there was a very clumsy effort over the years to perform DNA testing on the evidence. It was only in August of last year that the clerks in Columbus County, where he was tried, were cleaning and sorting through their evidence room, and somebody climbs up on a ladder and sees this envelope that was lying flat on the top shelf of the evidence room, and they take a look at it, and they see his name, they see the file number, and obviously everybody in the clerk's office knew his name because he'd written letter after letter after letter through the years. So they were able to send that evidence away for testing, and in December, a private laboratory in Pennsylvania definitively declared that the hairs could not belong to Joseph Sledge.
December of 2012, evidence proves he didn't do it. This is April of 2013. What does it take to get out?
Sometimes the wheels of justice move a little slowly, Frank. What's happening now is that the attorney for Joseph Sledge, Christine Muma, who heads the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, has engaged with the district attorney in that district and asked him to look at the evidence and asked him to join her in a joint motion before the judge to see if they could undo the conviction and get him out. She filed a formal motion for appropriate relief to actually get the conviction overturned. So the matter's now in the courts. The clock has been set. In about 2 months, the judge will either have to set a hearing on the matter or he could rule from the bench and determine that there's sufficient evidence to undo this conviction. So I know he's 68 years old and would desperately love for this to be fixed tomorrow, but it looks like it's going to move a little more slowly than that.
Well, this really points to how evidence is handled in evidence rooms in police stations around the state. Is there any sort of uniform code for how to handle evidence and not just sort of chance upon it a few years later because you're cleaning the evidence room?
That's the lesson in Joseph Sledge's case. I know every investigator in the state wished he had a crystal ball in the 1970s and 1980s and knew the significance of this evidence, but they didn't. And so evidence was kept haphazardly at best in many local police agencies and in the clerk's offices. It was only in 2001 that the legislature passed sweeping reforms in evidence collection and storage. And so now there's a really specific regimen and plan for how you must retain certain biological evidence in certain cases and the process that you have to go through if you're going to destroy that evidence to make more room in your clerk's office. But still, that doesn't do much to help people like Joseph Sledge, who were still in prison for crimes decades ago. And so there are at least 45 cases that Christine Muma at the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence knows about that DNA would definitively determine whether the inmate's claim of innocence was valid, and the evidence is nowhere to be found. It's either lost or destroyed.
Well, sadly, Joseph Sledge is not the only wrongfully convicted person in the state of North Carolina. There's another case of wrongful conviction and new developments in the case of Lamont Armstrong. Tell us about him.
So Lamont Armstrong served 17 years of a life sentence, and just this month, he had all of his charges wiped away. He was released last summer. The Duke Wrongful Convictions Clinic worked with his case, and this case moved a little bit differently than Joseph Sledge's in that the police and prosecutors worked very closely with lawyers at Duke and students there to examine his case. Last summer, the judge said he was at least due another trial. At that point, police and prosecutors found old evidence in the case that was tested, and the evidence pointed to another suspect in the case. So this month, the police prosecutors and the lawyers from the Duke Law Clinic came together to court, petitioned together to the judge to undo the conviction, dismiss all the charges, and essentially try and wipe his slate clean.
It's pretty clear in cases like Joseph Sledge, Lamont Armstrong, and the many others that have been reported over the past decade or so. And the fact is, I guess, there are remedies in North Carolina, some of which are unique. There's a Racial Justice Act and a wrongful and an actual innocence commission that are unique to North Carolina. Tell us how they play a role in uncovering these cases and at least rectifying the case, even though it's after the fact.
Sure. North Carolina is set apart in its ability to examine innocence claims in that we have an organization, it's a governmental organization called the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. It was created by statute in 2006, and this agency has the power to subpoena evidence and witnesses, to go into police departments and clerk's offices and examine on their own whether evidence exists in this case. And they, if they investigate the case and determine there's enough evidence to proceed, they'll hold a hearing. And if they believe that the person is innocent, they can kick it over to three judges who have the power to not only set the person free, but grant an exoneration, which is a separate and apart status for these individuals that enables them to be compensated by the state for the years that they spent in prison wrongly convicted.
Mandy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Frank.
Mandy Locke is a reporter with the News and Observer. This is The State of Things. Just ahead, a preview of Elaine Orr's newest book, A Different Sun, on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned.